Danny Ruiz had been running nets on the Illinois River for 21 years. On a Tuesday morning in March, he pulled his nets at first light and stood in the boat without moving. Not because the nets were empty, because what was missing from them had defined every single pull he had made for the last 11 years. He looked at his partner. His partner looked at the water. Then Danny said it quietly, almost to himself. The carp are gone. He was not wrong. And what scientists found when they went looking for an explanation will change the way you think about every river in this country. Because the answer was not a government program. It was not a removal campaign or a new technology or a policy decision made in a federal office. It was something that had lived in that river for 100 million years, something humans spent decades trying to destroy, and something that, without anyone planning it or funding it or even fully noticing it, had quietly come back and started doing what it had always done. We are going to show you exactly what that is. But first, you need to understand what it came back to fight. Because nothing about this story makes sense until you see how completely Asian carp took over American rivers, and how badly everything humans tried to stop them failed. In some stretches of the Illinois River, Asian carp now make up more than 90% of the total fish biomass in the water. 90%! Every native species that belonged in that river for thousands of years compressed into the remaining 10% of available space. That is not an invasion. That is a replacement. And it happened within a single human lifetime. Asian carp were deliberately introduced into sewage treatment ponds and aquaculture facilities across the American South in the early 1970s. The logic seemed reasonable at the time. These fish consume algae and suspended particles with extraordinary efficiency. They would clean the water. They would reduce management costs. What nobody adequately planned for was what happens when those ponds flood, because they did flood. And when the first major flooding events hit those facilities in the late 1970s, the fish went over the walls and into the drainage channels, and from the drainage channels, they found the tributaries. And from the tributaries, they found the Mississippi River. And at that point, the outcome was already decided. A single mature female bighead carp produces between 500,000 and 1 million eggs in a single spawning season. They reach reproductive maturity in 2 to 3 years. They had no natural predators in American river systems capable of managing their numbers at any meaningful scale. Within 2 decades, they had pushed north into the Illinois River, the Ohio River, and dozens of connected waterways across the entire Midwest. Tom Wrightson farmed soybeans on the floodplain outside Peoria for 30 years. In 2009, he watched from the bank as the river he had known his entire life moved differently than it ever had. The surface broken constantly, rolling and churning, fish bodies visible in every direction. The water itself had changed color. Where it had once been clear enough to see bottom in the shallows, it was now a permanent murky brown. The carp fed by rooting through sediment and stirring it into permanent suspension. Sunlight stopped reaching the riverbed. Aquatic plant beds that had anchored the food web for native species disappeared across large sections of river. The invertebrates that depended on those plants declined. The native fish that depended on those invertebrates declined. The birds that depended on those fish declined. An entire connected system began collapsing from the bottom up. Tom called the state wildlife office and described what he was seeing. The agent told him they were aware of the situation. Tom asked what they were going to do about it. There was a pause. They were working on it. They worked on it for a long time, and they never solved it. The federal government authorized electric barrier systems on the Chicago Sanitary and Ship Canal at a cost exceeding $200 million. The Army Corps of Engineers studied a permanent physical separation of the two water systems at a projected cost of billions more. Commercial fishermen ran organized removal events, pulling tens of thousands of pounds from the water in single operations. Marketing campaigns tried to rebrand silver carp as silverfin and sell it to American consumers. None of it shifted the population at the level that mattered. To simply hold a local carp population flat, not reduce it, just stop it from growing, wildlife managers calculated they needed to remove between 50 and 70% of the fish present every single year. No program ever came close to that threshold. The fish reproduced faster than any human effort could compensate for. And then something started happening that none of those programs could explain. Dr. Alicia Strand had been monitoring fish population dynamics in the Illinois River for 9 years. She was not someone who drew fast conclusions. She ran the numbers three separate ways before she called her supervisor, because what she was looking at showed something her 9 years of data had never produced. In a 12-mile corridor that had logged the highest consistent carp biomass of any section in her entire study area, the numbers across three consecutive seasons were tracking downward. Not crashing, moving steadily in a direction they had never moved in any previous monitoring period on record. She loaded her equipment into her truck and drove to the river before sunrise the following morning. She was expecting to find evidence of a removal operation she had not been informed about. Illegal netting, something mechanical. What she found instead were tracks pressed into the muddy bank at the water's edge. Enormous, distinctive, unmistakable tracks belonging to an animal, her. Monitoring program had never once logged in that corridor. An animal that most wildlife managers working that river would have told you had not been present in meaningful numbers in that section of the Illinois River within any living person's memory. She photographed the tracks and drove back to her office and started pulling historical records she had never had reason to look at before. And what she found in those records is what changes this entire story. Alligator gar. That is what made the tracks. That is what was in the corridor. And that is what the carp numbers had been responding to for three consecutive seasons without anyone connecting the two things until Dr. Strand pulled both data sets and put them side by side. The alligator gar is one of the oldest fish species alive on this planet. Its fossil record runs back more than 100 million years. An adult alligator gar reaches 10 feet in length and 300 pounds. Its scales are interlocking, diamond-shaped, so dense and hard that early American settlers used them as arrowheads. Its jaw carries two rows of sharp teeth and opens wide enough to take prey that looks impossibly large for any freshwater fish. For thousands of years, the alligator gar sat at the apex of the freshwater food web across the American South and Midwest. It regulated populations of rough fish. It kept rivers from Texas to Illinois functioning the way those systems had always functioned. Then came the 20th century. Alligator gar were targeted by commercial fishermen and by wildlife managers who incorrectly believed they were harmful predators competing with more desirable game fish. Electrofishing campaigns were organized specifically to reduce their numbers. Dam construction blocked migratory routes and cut off the backwater habitats where they historically spawned. By the 1970s, they had been eliminated from most of their northern range. In Illinois, Missouri, and Arkansas, they had effectively disappeared from the rivers they had occupied for 100 million years. Now here is the part that reframes everything. The vacuum left by alligator gar disappearing from northern river systems in the 1970s was not just an ecological loss. It was the open door that Asian carp walked through when the first floods hit those aquaculture ponds in 1979. The invasion did not happen because American rivers were otherwise healthy ecosystems that a powerful invasive species overwhelmed. The invasion happened because American rivers were already missing their most important predator. The carp did not create the problem. They filled a vacancy that humans had already created. And in the 12-mile corridor on the Illinois River, where Dr. Strand's data was showing something impossible, that vacancy had quietly begun to close. What she found in the historical records was a state stocking program that had been running in that specific section of the river since 2008. Missouri and Illinois wildlife agencies had been releasing hatchery-raised juvenile alligator gar into backwater habitats as part of a native species restoration effort. The program was not designed to address Asian carp. Nobody had connected it to carp management. It was a biodiversity program. It had been running for 15 years before the fish data from Danny Ruiz's nets gave anyone a reason to ask whether the two things were related. The mechanism is straightforward once you see it. Adult Asian carp are difficult prey. Their size and speed make them hard targets for most native predators. But juvenile carp in their first and second year are a completely different calculation. An adult alligator gar holding in cover in shallow backwater habitat has the speed and jaw capacity to take juvenile carp consistently across an entire spawning season. And that predation operates at a level that direct removal of adult fish never manages to reach. You do not need to kill every fish in a river. You need to reduce juvenile survival rates below the replacement threshold year after year until the reproductive output of the population drops below the level that sustains the numbers. The alligator gar had been doing exactly that across 15 years of stocking events in that corridor. Nobody had been watching for that effect. Nobody had thought to look. Dr. Strand spent 6 months cross-referencing stocking records with population monitoring data before she submitted her findings. The correlation between alligator gar presence and declining juvenile carp survival rates held across every analytical approach she applied. It was not proof of a single clean causal relationship. Ecosystems never produce those. But it was consistent enough and directionally clear enough that it forced a conversation inside Illinois and Missouri wildlife management that had never happened before. A conversation about whether native predator restoration and invasive species control were actually the same program, operating in the same river, just never recognized as connected, until a researcher with 9 years of data put the two data sets next to each other on the same screen. Now here is where this story stops being about one corridor on the Illinois River and starts being about something much larger. The Great Lakes represent the largest freshwater system on the planet. $7 billion in recreational and commercial fishing every single year. 40 million people drawing drinking water from those lakes. Asian carp are still pushing north through the Illinois River toward Lake Michigan. The electric barriers on the Chicago Sanitary and Ship Canal are still the only thing standing between the established carp population and open water access to the Great Lakes. If those fish establish in Lake Michigan, the economic and ecological consequences would be permanent, and they would be severe in a way that makes everything that happened to the Illinois River look like a preview. Alligator gar recovery programs are currently operating in Missouri, Illinois, Arkansas, and Tennessee. The fish are long-lived and slow to reach reproductive maturity. The stocking events that produced the corridor Dr. Strand was studying took 15 years to generate a measurable population effect. 15 years. The electric barriers on the Chicago Canal have been in operation since 2002. They have held, but barriers fail. Floods redirect water. Infrastructure ages. The question of whether alligator gar recovery can expand far enough north and establish in sufficient numbers to create a biological buffer inside the river system before the barriers are ever seriously tested is a question that nobody in American freshwater management has a confident answer to right now. Tom Wrightson walked his floodplain boundary last fall and noticed something he had not seen in more than a decade. The shallows near the bank were clearer than he could remember them being. Not clear the way they were before the carp arrived, but clearer than they had been in any season he could put a recent date to. He does not have a scientific explanation for it. He has not read the monitoring data, or the stocking records, or Dr. Strand's analysis. He just knows what that river has looked like for 30 years, and he knows the difference between water that is getting worse and water that might, for the first time in a very long time, be moving in the other direction. The alligator gear did not come back to save American rivers. It came back because enough people made enough decisions over enough years to give a native animal the space and the time it needed to begin recovering in a landscape where it had always belonged. What followed was not planned. It was just what happens when a biological relationship that humans spent decades dismantling begins slowly and imperfectly to put itself back together. Whether it happens fast enough, in enough sections of river, before the barriers that separate the Great Lakes from the carp population are ever seriously tested, is the question that every freshwater biologist working that system right now is carrying with them every single morning. Danny Ruiz still runs his nets before sunrise. The hauls are not what they were before the invasion. They will not be for a long time. But they are different from what they were 3 years ago. He cannot explain the difference in the language of trophic cascades or juvenile survival thresholds. He just has 21 years of mornings on that river and the particular feeling of a net coming up differently than it did the season before. He noticed the change before the scientists formally documented it. He just did not yet know what he was noticing or how old the thing that caused it actually was. Can the alligator gar recover far enough north, fast enough to matter for the Great Lakes? Drop your answer in the comments below. And if this story changed the way you think about what is already working inside America's rivers, right now, subscribe to Terra Factor. We will see you in the next one.